Reagan, they didn't want to hear anything about any wider conspiracy going on. They had it figured out that a bunch of Republicans had broken in on the Democrats, and that was their story, and they were sticking to it. But in the meantime, we were trying to push the real story that there was a lot more danger to the sovereignty of the United States going on than just a simple burglary. And I had quite a few problems at that point. But we kept pushing with the story, and finally Carl Rowan broke it in the old Washington Star. This is how he put it. Those who wonder about the president's emotional balance have now begun to suspect that even in the face of a vote to impeach, he might try as commander-in-chief to use the military forces to keep himself in power. That was the very first thing. Of course, Nixon later resigned in August of 74, I believe it was. Just a month later, it came out that Nixon's own sitting Secretary of Defense, Jim Schlossinger, had also become very concerned about the president's emotional health, and had moved troops from North Carolina, or had put the 82nd Airborne on alert, and had ordered the Joint Chiefs to, quote, keep a tight watch on the military chain of command to ensure that no extraordinary orders came out from the White House during this period of uncertainty. So it was really a remarkable time in American history that only my book has ever dared to take on, other than in the 80s, Seymour Hersh wrote a lengthy piece in the Atlantic Monthly. But that is the sum total of this most extraordinary historical event.
Well, it really is an amazing story, and the fact that you could suppress this in America simply is a reflection of the degree of control that exists today over what the American people think. And Seymour Hersh is one of the few people that, even though he's on the far left, I really enjoy his articles, because I think he's inherently honest. And that's I think that you'll find very little of that, you know, within the media today. If they want to keep their jobs, why, you know, they simply toe the line.
Yeah, well, we talked to Seymour Hersh on several occasions, and although he would not break the story at the time when it was really important to the safety of the United States for the story to be broken, he had gathered enough information, so he cashed in on it a few years later.
And where did he write that article?
Oh, gosh, let me see.
Well, it doesn't really matter. All right, well, anyway, of course, then this got you interested in what was really going on behind the scenes, and you began studying the ancient secret societies, because you can't understand anything going on today unless you understand the mysteries, unless you understand there have been secret societies going back literally thousands of years. And, of course, the purpose of these secret societies was to tap into the other dimension, the dimension that the mediums and the clairvoyants and the legitimate fortune tellers. There's a lot of quacks out there, but there really are people who do have the ability to contact the other dimensions. So what did you find as you began looking into that?
Well, I mean, the whole purpose was I could see that you know, when Nixon was forced to resign. And I can't really give you all the specific factors at the time that were at play in my brain, but it was clear to me that there was, and shocking to me, that there were forces greater than the President of the United States at work here. There were forces who could tell him, and I'm not just talking about, you know, a congressional delegation going to him and telling him to resign, because that just, under the circumstances, that just would not have made him do it. There must have been something else in my mind, and so I had to try to find out what it was. And ultimately, what I found out was that there is a group who has been in operation throughout history, who has maintained this notion that the world can be saved by humankind if they would only return to this mythical concept of Atlantis, whereby nationalism would be eliminated, wars would be eliminated, and thereby we could create a heaven on earth. Now, anybody who knows anything about the Bible knows that this is just total nonsense, and in fact, Plato himself writes in the Atlantean of the Atlantean myth that Atlantis was destroyed by God because it had become so corrupt. And that's exactly what the very basis, the heart of my contention here is that this group of people is trying to eliminate national sovereignty, trying to eliminate the individual ability of nation states to go to war when they see an injustice in the world. And, the Star Trek concept is if we can just eliminate nationalism, we can eliminate war, and thereby we're all going to live in a big, happy world. But it's just not the case. As British Lord Acton's axiom goes, absolute power tends to corrupt absolutely. Once a nationalism is eliminated and basically a world government takes place, then the person in charge of that world government, by the very definition, will become ultimately corrupt, infinitely corrupt, and bring about an ironclad world dictatorship. And that's exactly why, it's sad to say but true, but it's this ability of nation states to go to war and have independent national sovereignty is the only thing that keeps us free. And once that's sufficiently eroded, then nothing can take place but this ironclad world dictatorship, which they're going to try to usher in as being something good and Atlantean, and they call the New World Order.
And there really are people out there who want to reconstitute lost Atlantis that Plato wrote about in his dialogues, and yet it was totally corrupt. Well, you can see the same thing here in America today, and really so much throughout the world, a total breakdown in morality, almost like it was in the time of ancient Atlantis. And of course, a question in many people's minds, since ancient Atlantis was destroyed by a great flood because it was so corrupt, is this the world that Noah was writing about that was so corrupt that God decided to destroy the entire world other than Noah and his family?
Well, yes, that's exactly what I believe. In fact, I'm not even sure if Atlantis did exist, then yes, that's probably the case. I'm not even sure that Atlantis did exist. That's why I refer to it as the Atlantean legend. It's only mentioned one time in legitimate literature, and that's this one thing that Plato wrote. It seems to me that when major events occur, the thing that historians use to verify, to be sure that something is accurate, is you see it from multiple sources. Especially the farther back you go, then these sources tend to all be the same, say the same thing. That's why it's so difficult to work out historical events in the recent past, the last few decades, because there's so much hype that you really can't figure it out until several decades have gone by.
And I think you're absolutely right, and we will never know whether Atlantis actually existed or whether this is simply a myth, but it doesn't really matter. There are people who believe it existed, and many of these people hold positions of great power and influence, and they are working, as Sir Francis Bacon said, for the new Atlantis. And Bacon died in 1626, somewhere in there. But, of course, his legacy is still with us. And we'll be talking a little bit more about Bacon and the secret societies and their coming to America. And then the emblem on the back of the dollar bill. We'll be back here in just a moment with our special guest, William Stell. His book, The New World Order, we think is very important. It's vitally important that the average American has an opportunity to get the information you're not going to get out of textbooks. You're not going to get from your teachers. You're not going to get from your ministers. And yet it all has to do with the spiritual forces at work in America today. Well, Dr. Stan, our guest is William Stell. William, why don't you pick up the story, how does this tie into America, and how do these ancient or mysterious religions influence what's going on today?
Okay, well, I just have to pound home this one point, because it is the major contention of the book, and I think it's the most important political issue that anybody can understand. And that is, what is it that makes America free? What has made the American experiment the most successful experiment in human governance in the history of the world? What has it about the American experiment that finally has lifted humankind above serfdom, above servitude? It's not anything written specifically in the Constitution, and yet it is absolutely intrinsic in the thrust of the Constitution, and that is the separation of powers concept. What is a separation of powers concept? That is, the Founding Fathers and their wisdom knew that absolute power tends to make people become corrupt absolutely. So how did they deal with that? They spread the power of government out across a whole lot of people, and they made those powers competing. So they made this natural tension. They made it difficult for the American government to really get anything accomplished, but that's good. It's very slow, it's very ponderous, it's very expensive, but it's very, very safe. And that is the essence of why America has been so free. What is the separation of powers concept on the international level? As I said before, sad to say but true, it is the ability, it's national sovereignty, the independent ability of nation states to make war on each other. Well, what would have happened had not nation states, what would have happened had the League of Nations actually been in place when Hitler rose to power, so that nation states might have been militarily gutted so that they couldn't have ganged up and fought a war against Hitler? Well, we would have had Hitler's New World Order, and that's exactly what he called it, and Hitler would still be ruling the world today. And yes, there wouldn't be any war anymore, and yes, we might have more resources to go out and explore the stars, a la Star Trek, but no, we would not have the freedoms that we enjoy today, especially here in this country. So that's why this national sovereignty issue is so important, but so difficult for people to understand, and so easy for the folks' intent on eliminating human freedom, pushing forward this Star Trek-like concept that nationalism is bad, internationalism is good. We just have to know why nationalism is so important. Yes, there's a price to be paid, but the price of not having it is far, far greater.
All right. Well, now, where do the ancient secret societies fit into what has happened here in America? What is their impact on America today?
Well, they're for example, the Masonic Order has been working steadfastly to bring about this concept of internationalism. In their own literature, they have bragged that they have even taken the Bible and essentially Christian values, Judeo-Christian values, out of the public education system. Although the Masons are not the only people responsible here, they are certainly an important part.
And in fact, we have between 2 and 3 million Masons, with their families, probably close to 10 million people. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is William Still, and William was simply pointing out that with nationhood, we have the opportunity to maintain freedom. Once you put all power with a central authority, where is our freedom going to come from? It won't come from God, as we have manifested here, this concept that freedom comes from God. You will have an all-powerful government that will regulate every aspect of human endeavor and crush the human spirit. And that's what the effort for world government is all about. Now, we were talking then about the influence of secret societies in America. Most people don't even stop to think we have 2 to 3 million members of the Masonic fraternity who have sworn an oath to support the great architect of the universe and to search for the light. And, of course, most of them don't know, but the light that they're searching for is Lucifer. And these people hold key positions in literally every community in our court system and highly placed within our government today. So but there are other secret societies you were talking about. Certainly Masonry isn't the only secret society, is it, Bill?
No, it's not. It's not the only secret society, but it's really the only one worth focusing in on today, because it's the only one that's really active today, other than the Odd Fellows, which were basically just another name Masonry took during the middle 1800s. After the great Masonic expose of Captain Morgan.
And when Captain Morgan was killed because he exposed the secrets of Masonry, isn't that right? Somewhere.
Yes,
in the
he was the first one to actually publish word for word the first 3 degrees of the Blue Lodge, and he paid for it with his life. But the essence of the Masonic order, though, is once again the deception is very subtle, and that is that they tell their folks that yes, we are trying to build a heaven on earth. We are trying to perfect humans, and that's what the initiated steps of our order are designed to do, is to bring about, you know, human perfection, and thereby we're going to bring about, although they never mention Atlantis, at least in the lower degrees, but that's the idea, that they're trying to, that mankind can do it on his own, that he doesn't need God, he certainly doesn't need an intercessor between man and God, that mankind can, through these initiated steps, can himself become God. And, you know, we see this thing, the exact same thing in the tale of the Tower of Babel in the Bible.
And I think that it's so important that the average Mason really doesn't understand Masonry. But just as when you ask Christ to come into your life and to transform your life, and your life, if you are sincere, your life really is transformed. So when the Mason asks for the light, and he's searching for the light, and he asks for it to come into his life, why, he, of course, is asking for Lucifer to come in. And he begins drawing further and further away from the Christian message, adopting this idea of the brotherhood of man under the fatherhood of the great architect of the universe, who is not the God of the Bible.
Well, it tends to steer. If Masons are anything, they're very anti-Christian, and it tends to steer folks away from the concept, because really humbling yourself. And saying that, you know, I can't do it on my own. I need an intercessor between man and God is a very humbling experience. And masonry doesn't breed humility, it breeds pride. That, you know, man, yes, we can do it ourselves. We don't need this Jesus Christ character. You know, we can become God ourselves. You know, and you see that down throughout history. There's absolutely nothing new about that.
And, of course, the thing is that the Mason looks forward to, going to stand before the great white architect, great white throne. And that's, of course, what he believes is his entrance to heaven. But the trouble is he's never read the Bible. He doesn't know that the great white throne is not where Christians go. The great white throne is the judgment of the damned. So it's there, it's right there in the book of Revelation, but the average individual has no idea what's really going on.
Right.
So let's get a little bit then, of course, into finance, because much of your book is a summary of your second book, going into the background of what's happening financially in the world, because you can't understand anything going on unless you understand the financial forces which direct the lives of literally everybody in the world today. As the average individual, they work for a salary. They put aside money for their old age. They pay for products with money, but where does the money come from? And I think you'll be fascinated as William begins to explore the history of money. And this is the second part of the book, and you'll find all sorts of information there that is not readily available elsewhere. And unless you understand the history of money, unless you understand the theory of money, unless you begin making preparations now for what lies ahead, why, I fear that many people listening to this program today may one day find themselves simply penniless, impoverished, as has happened in other countries throughout the world within the last 2 decades, as the currencies have collapsed. And the thing is, at one time money had inherent wealth. Today, well, it's worth, well, not even sometimes worth the paper it's written on. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, William Still. William, why don't you go ahead and talk about money, because part of your book, a very important part of your book, analyzes the monetary system, and I think that you've done a wonderful job with that.
Well, you know, you have to understand that just as the bad guys have understood that in order for them to succeed, they have to consolidate power up to the international level in 3 very important areas. I see it as a power tripod. And if any one of these, the 3 legs of this tripod, is not totally under their control, their plan will fail miserably, as it has time and time again throughout history. That's the great thing about coming from a Christian's perspective, Stan, because we understand, if you just look at it, normally you think these guys have got these secret societies working for this, you know, for all these years. They've got all the money they want. They've got all the political connections they want, and yet they can't succeed. How come? Well, of course, you and I know it's just the power of God's Holy Spirit pushing, you know, little guys like you and me on to do the right thing, you know, and hundreds of us, you know, simultaneously doing the right thing, even though we're not connected, and that's the only way thing that's beating them. So anyway, in this power tripod, they have to consolidate power into three important legs, which is the economic leg, the political leg, and interestingly enough, but equally important, the religious leg. So on the economic front, I think they're the most far advanced. They've been working at this for hundreds of years. The battle on the economic front has exhibited itself nowhere in the world as importantly and starkly as here in the United States throughout the entire history of our country. This all started economically back in about 1100 AD in England, when King Henry I discovered that the goldsmiths, the folks who loaned out their gold coins and ran the economy, there was a totally gold-based money at that point, could control the political fate of the king by manipulating the economy. For example, if they wanted to have the good times roll economically, they would do just as Alan Greenspan did a few years ago, and that's create a lot of money, loan out their gold coins liberally. Thereby, there's a lot of money in circulation, and everybody was happy, and they were happy with the king. But if they didn't like the king or what the king did, then what they would do would they would call in their loans, and they would not make new loans of their gold coins. And thereby, a depression set in, and they discovered that they didn't get the blame for this, that the king got the blame. Well, the king, King Henry, got tired of this, and he said, you know what? I'm tired of this. We're going to create a new system. I'm going to issue the money. So he issued simple sticks of wood.
Hold that thought right there. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is William Still. His book is a fascinating book, and it's entitled The New World Order. And William is going into the background of the monetary system, pointing out that you can go back into the 1100s and in England, why the king at that time was very unhappy with the goldsmiths who controlled the economy, because he who controls the economy, who controls the issuing of money, whether it be in gold coins or script or whatever it be, really controls the economy, and that the goldsmiths like the king, why they would go ahead and make lots of money available, make loans based upon the gold coins that they held. If they didn't like the king, they'd contract the economy, that certainly money would not be available, and everybody would get mad, but not at the goldsmiths, who had contracted the economy and limited the circulation of money, but at the king. So the king at that time decided he was going to issue the money, and you pick up the story there, Bill.
Yeah, so they were basically little sticks of wood with notches carved in them, and then the stick was split lengthwise down so it would be in two halves, and the identical notches would be in each half. The king would keep one half, and he'd spend the other half into the economy, and he found that he could make anything be money simply by declaring it good for the payment of taxes. So these tally sticks became money, and the greatest empire in the history of the world, the British Empire, was built on the backs of tally sticks. They were in circulation for over 600 years until the Bank of England finally took control and burned all the tally sticks and created their own paper money. In the United States, for example, in early colonial America, we see the same thing going on. Benjamin Franklin, when he was ambassador to Great Britain, was asked by the Bank of England officials, he said, how come America is becoming so rich? And Franklin put it this way in his autobiography, quote, that is simple. In the colonies, we issue our own money. It's called colonial scrip. We issue it in proper proportion to the demands of trade and industry to make the products pass easily from producers to consumers. In this manner, creating ourselves our own paper money, we control its purchasing power, and we have no interest to pay to no one. Well, the bank found that very interesting, so that what did they do? They quickly outlawed this colonial scrip, and just, you know, a country issuing their own money and not having the bankers issue the money. Outrageous. So they had passed through Parliament something called the Currency Act of 1764. What did it do? It outlawed colonial scrip. It made the colonies go strictly on a gold and pay all their debts only in gold or silver coins. Of course, that bankrupted the colonies immediately because there wasn't much gold or silver over here in the colonies at that point. And according to Franklin, quote, in 1 year, the conditions were so reversed in the United States, or in America, that the era of prosperity ended and the depression set in to such an extent that the streets of the colonies were filled with unemployed. So in school, most of us learned that it was the Stamp Act that passed the next year, or the Tea Act of 1773, which led to the Boston Tea Party, which basically was the start of the American Revolution. But Franklin puts a different spin on it. This is how, once again, he put it in his autobiography, quote, the colonies would gladly have borne the little tax on tea and other matters had it not been that England took away from the colonies their money, which created unemployment and dissatisfactions, close quote. So here we have none less authority than Benjamin Franklin saying that the real root cause of the American Revolution was not the Stamp Act or the Tea Act or any of that sort of stuff, but it was the Great Britain taking away from the colonies the ability to issue their own money, and that's absolutely key. The money, as in the words of Abraham Lincoln, is the most important thing that a government can do for its country. Not defend the nation, not anything else. It's issuing our own money. That's what Lincoln did with greenbacks. That's what I propose should be done today, to take the power away from the privately owned Central Bank of the United States, which is now called the Federal Reserve System, and put it back in the hands of the closest elected representatives of the people, namely the lower house of Congress.
All right. Well, then basically what happened was that they had a revolution in the United States. A new country was formed. And then, of course, the man named Alexander Hamilton, who was a Mason, who was very close to the British financial interests, who himself was an elitist. He wanted really almost a monarchy here in the United States. He stopped out of the Constitutional Convention because they wouldn't go along with him by electing a president for life. He was really an elitist, but he ended up as Secretary of the Treasury, and he convinced George Washington, President Washington, that we needed a central bank. Do you want to pick up the story from there? Because that was the first bank of the United States. There had been, I suppose, a bank even earlier than that that had issued the continental currency. Maybe you'd want to cover the story of continental currency that was issued to finance the Revolutionary War, and then we'll get into the first bank of the United States.
Well, yeah, whenever you talk about how a paper money would be a good thing, people are always quick to point out, oh my God, you know, George Washington himself used to, his famous quote is, a wheelbarrow load of money will barely buy, you know, a sack of groceries or whatever. Well, yeah, that's what happens when you issue too much money, which a country does every single time it goes to war. And there's just no way around it. That's what happens. But what you have to do is educate the population that the amount of money in circulation is the most important political issue on everybody's platter at every federal election. And then things would go right with this country. In any case, Hamilton manipulated the Constitution so that it deliberately left out any mention of the federal role in the creation of paper money. So then after the Constitution was implemented, he went into Washington and goes, oh, you know what? We made this mistake. We forgot to mention the federal role. Well, I'll tell you what. I've got these friends over in England and the Bank of England, and they've got a lot of experience issuing paper money. Why don't we just give them a monopoly on a paper money? Washington had lots of problems trying to keep this country together. He didn't need the financial problems. So he said, okay, Hamilton, go ahead, do it. And so they chartered the first Bank of the United States.
Now, I should point out that both Madison and Jefferson were totally against that. They realized this was going to be a disaster because it was going to give the people in England the ability to direct the course of the American economy.
Well,
right?
Yeah, I mean, they were very well aware, as was, and they got it from Franklin, of course, what the key to national prosperity was, and that's maintaining the ability to control the nation's own currency.
But of course, the central bank, somebody else controlled our currency. We didn't, the Congress didn't, the President didn't. It was Hamilton and his friends over in England.
And keep in mind, all of these central banks, what the big deception in is just the name itself. These central banks are disguised to appear to be representing the nation, when in fact all they're doing is representing the banks. Bank of England, Deutsche Bank, Bank of France, Federal Reserve System. The names are always designed to mimic the fact of what they really should be doing, namely issuing money for the benefit of all equally, instead of issuing money for the benefit of the bankers alone.
And this has been the problem down through the years. We always have a central bank that's privately owned that works to actually profit the bankers. And this was, of course, what Andrew Jackson pointed out, that, you know, all men, you know, have different capabilities. And there's certain people who are very wealthy and certain people who are poor. But why should the government establish a bank that would make the rich grow richer and not give those same opportunities to the poor? And I think if you read those speeches by Jackson, I think you have those in your book, don't you?
Oh, yes. In fact, I've got it right here. It is to be regretted that the rich and powerful too often bent the acts of government to their selfish purposes. Distinctions in society will always exist under every just government. Equality of talents, of education, or of wealth cannot be produced by human institutions. In the full enjoyment of the gifts of heaven and the fruits of superior industry, economy, and virtue, every man is equally entitled to protection by law. But when the laws undertake to add to these natural and just advantages artificial distinctions to grant titles, gratuities, and exclusive privileges to make the rich richer and the potent more powerful, the humble members of society, the farmers, the mechanics, the laborers, who have neither the time nor the means of securing like favors to themselves, have a right to complain of the injustice of their government. There are no necessary evils in government. Its evils exist only in its abuses. If it would confine itself to equal protection, and as heaven does its rain, shower its favor alike on the high and the low, the rich and the poor, it would be an unqualified blessing. In the act before me, there seems to be a wide and a necessary departure from these just principles. And, of course, what he was talking about was the chartering of the second bank of the United States.
And, of course, Andrew Jackson did the unthinkable. He refused to sign the legislation, and he killed the Second Bank of the United States and actually preserved, to some extent, our freedom for another 100 years. So we can thank Andrew Jackson for that. Well, it was about 80 years from there, 1932, 1936, Second Bank died. And then, of course, they did everything they could to disrupt our economy, to punish the people for not going along with their superiors, with the elite who control the monetary system. But the people rallied behind Andrew Jackson, repudiated the bankers, and, well, they paid a financial price for it, but at least they maintained their freedom.
Well, they paid a short-term financial price. I mean, the bankers immediately withdrew all their loans. They caused an immediate and deep depression in the United States. And that's just what's great about this country. When you look at its history, from the financial history, you see that nowhere else in the world have the people attacked this problem time and time again. Nowhere other than the United States have they offered any sort of serious resistance to this financial leg of this power pyramid. And it is a fascinating story, totally overlooked by American history books, and I think it should be mandatory in all schools.
And I have a set of the speeches of Andrew Jackson, and the one that Bill had just quoted, I'd found, you know, in his Andrew Jackson speech when he refused to ratify the charter of the Second Bank of the United States. And what a pleasure it was actually to see it reproduced in Bill's book, where, of course, anybody who gets the book will have that. And it needs to be read many times. Andrew Jackson was a very wise man who really cared about the common people. He'd come from common heritage, and he really felt very, very strongly that the elite, and there was an elite in those days too, you know, wanted to use the government to enrich themselves. And there's nothing new under the sun. We can see what's going on over in Iraq today. And Halliburton, you know, I don't know, they're still paying that deferred salary to Dick Cheney, but Halliburton gets all these wonderful contracts, no-bid contracts. This is simply a means of transferring wealth from the poor people in a rich country to the rich people in a rich country. And so anyway, this story goes on, and then of course we end up with the Federal Reserve System. And then of course there was periods of prosperity and contraction of the economy, always done by the bankers, and the people were pretty unhappy. There was a Great Depression in 1907. The people were demanding a stable monetary system, and so, well, the people who had created all the problems decided that they were going to come up with a solution. Do you want to pick up the story there?
Well, they created the problems deliberately. I mean, there was nothing accidental. There is no such thing as a business cycle. This is just smoke and mirrors on the part of a monetary economist to try to make you think that the economy is too complicated for you to possibly tackle or figure out. It's not complicated at all. There is only one question in all of economics as it relates to the federal government, and that is, who has the power to create the money? Who has the power to control the quantity of money in circulation? That is the most powerful power in the monetary universe. And as I said before, it's changed hands 7 different times throughout American history. It's only changed hands, as far as I know, once or twice in all other countries put together. So the United States has always led the way in that regard, and I think we can turn the clock back once again, and just have the government issue the money, and it would just gut the bad guys and all of their New World Order plans.
And really, if you study this whole issue of money, you find it really ties in my estimation, to this whole world occult movement that Bill has written so beautifully about in his first book, which is called The New World Order, The Ancient Plan of Secret Society. So in 1913, why the elite put one over on the American people. They pretended to be opposing the Federal Reserve System, which is actually, this was their legislation. And most people thought it was the Federal Reserve, that's the government. Well, of course, we love that line, the Federal Reserve is about as federal as Federal Express. It's a privately owned central bank that controls our economy, and until the American people realize it's one of the greatest scams of all time, they're not going to understand anything going on or what lies ahead.
Right, and yeah, just keep in mind, this is only one leg of the power tripod. They have to control the political and the religious leg as well, but it's probably one of the most easily documentable as far as the struggle that's gone on. Now, we were back in the pre-1913 period, where they created a series of booms and busts and made the people so tired that they just started calling, you know, government's got to do something about this, our economy is a wreck. And so they brought on the Federal Reserve System, which is, of course, supposed to bring stability to the economy. And so what happens just, you know, 15 years after the Federal Reserve comes into play? Well, we had the greatest depression in the history of the country, the Great Depression. So the Federal Reserve didn't do much to protect us at that point, did they?
Well, of course, we've had booms and busts since then, and now we're in a boom time. Everything is really great. The stock market's still up. Price of housing is going up. Everything is great. And what people don't really understand is it's all artificial. It's based upon money that is based upon absolutely nothing. There's nothing behind that money other than your belief that it has value.
Well, it doesn't matter what backs the money. What matters is the quantity of it. That's why all the lowering of interest rates right around the time of the start of the Bush administration was designed to pump up the economy. And now, of course, Greenspan is bringing interest rates back up, which sucks money back out of the economy. Now, the interesting thing about this is the effect is not felt for 24 months. So 2 years from now, we're going to be seeing a rather different economic picture than we see today.
And, of course, during these times, why many people lose their homes, they lose, you know, they lose their cars, they lose their farms, they lose their businesses. But don't you worry about it. The government's already anticipated that. That's why they changed the bankruptcy laws, so that you can't go bankrupt. You can't get out of debt as you used to be able to. And increasingly, why we're going to lose our ability, to protect ourselves from our own folly. And at least in the past, you could go bankrupt. And it really didn't matter because, after all, the money that was created was based on nothing at all. It was all created by the Federal Reserve System. So you wrote it off. The banks didn't lose because there wasn't any money there to begin with. It was all a banking entry. We're going to be back in just a minute. We'll take Roger's call, and then we're going to have to let William Steele go. But his book, The New World Order. Oh, do you have a website you'd like to get out, Bill?
Just themoneymasters.com.
Themoneymasters.com. That's Bill Still's website. And we'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. We've got Roger on the line. He's been waiting patiently. Roger, do you have a question for our guest?
Yes, thank you, gentlemen. Isn't the only honest form of paper money as warehouse receipts for the real thing? And lastly...
Well, there was one question, and Bill and I will disagree on this, but I want you to hear what Bill has to say. Go ahead, Bill. Well, I think Roger is suggesting a gold-backed currency.
Oh, well, gold-backed currency is exactly what tally sticks were meant to fight against. We were on a gold-backed currency at the time of the Great Depression in the 30s. So it's not what backs the currency. You could back the currency with diamonds. You could back the currency with plutonium. It doesn't matter what backs the currency. What matters is who controls the quantity of the currency.
Well, that was my lastly part, was merely transferring the counterfeiting power, resting it from the Federal Reserve back to the Treasury, doesn't do anything to stop the counterfeiting. The Congress could still conceivably demand the inflation be done.
Okay. Oh, yeah, they could. That's absolutely right. That's why you have to have an informed electorate that insists that this is the quantity of money is the most important political issue on the horizon.
God bless.
Okay, thanks very much, Roger. And, do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners? We've got about a minute and a half now, and I'd like you to sort of wrap up your thoughts.
Well, my thoughts wrap up in just one thing, and that's oppose consolidation of power at every level. Power should be spread out to the greatest possible, to the greatest means practical. Oppose the New World Order concept. Support the concept of nationalism. I'm for American nationalism, French nationalism, Chinese nationalism. We have to have that independent ability of nation states to keep the world relatively free. And this New Atlantis concept, this United Nations concept, European Union, now we've got the African Union, they're trying to take it off piece at a time, regionally. You know, oppose that stuff. We have to have independent nation states protecting their own interests in order for the world to maintain any type of relative freedom.
And I really think that if it weren't for the people out there who are intensely creating wars, and who create such chaos that people will accept the world government, we would not have had the First World War or the Second World War or any of the other wars we've had since then. I believe they've all been contrived to drive us with a sense of hopelessness into this idea of the New World Order, which I believe will be a catastrophic. Bill, thank you so very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure to have you.
Don't lose hope, Stan.
Oh, I won't. Don't you worry. I'm more encouraged now than I've been ever before, and I've been at this for 43 years. So
they haven't beaten us yet.
They won't be as long as we're with God. God bless you. Good night.
God bless you.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. If you'd like to know more about Bill Still's book, The New World Order, well, you can give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. I have a new talk. It's on a DVD I gave called The Coming Economic Crisis, which will give you an overview of what's going on and what Alan Greenspan has said, what Paul Volcker has said, the history of money, what Aristotle said, what Plato said, what Sophocles said. These were all very wise men who lived thousands of years ago, and yet they faced many of the same problems we face today. So if you'd like, of course, to get that information, first of all, the DVD is available by calling 1-800-544-8927 if you'd like more information on it. And then, of course, we have a booklet we put together, and it's actually three of my newsletters dealing with the origin of money and the occult forces behind that. It's called A History of Money. A History of Money. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. I do want to ask everybody in the listening audience to call your congressman, to fax your congressman, to email your congressman, and don't write your congressman. They're afraid to open the letters for fear it might have anthrax in it. But email and fax and call your congressman and tell them to vote no on CAFTA, because CAFTA is simply a destruction of the sovereignty of the United States. We'll have all sorts of complications, including the bringing in the Codex Alimentarius. But the major thing is it will destroy our economy even further. And the people who tell you the opposite are simply lying to you. So let your congressman know how you feel and that you're going to remember how he votes on this issue. And believe me, if enough people call their congressman, I think that this is a winnable fight. Right now, they don't have the votes. They're bribing the congressman. They're twisting arms. They're threatening the congressman in Washington, D.C. today. That's how our government really works. And you must understand that the administration will do anything they can, because the whole basis of our current administration and the leaders of both political parties is not American sovereignty, but the destruction of our sovereignty. And merging us into this one world order and CAFTA is simply one stepping stone along the way towards the new world order, the new world religion, the new world economy. So call your congressman, and then I want to mention we are trying to add 18 stations to our evening program. And if you're out there, we're in the process of trying to build up support so we can do this. If you'd like to help us, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And if it comes to pass, why 18 additional stations will be hearing this program for at least 1 hour every evening. And then, of course, we do hope that many of you will go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. We do carry certain books on this issue. The Creature from Jekyll Island. That's The Creature from Jekyll Island. The Federal Reserve Conspiracy by Professor Sutton. Gold for Investment by Professor Sutton. Gold for Survival by Professor Sutton. And one of my favorites, it's just a little book. It's called The Fiat Money Inflation in France. It's the story of what happened in France in 1789. But if you don't understand history, you can't understand what's going on today. For as George Santayana told us, those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. Please go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. You can listen to our programs there directly or indirectly on the Internet 5 hours every day. You can listen to our archive programs, and we invite you to copy those, to pull down our newsletters, our last two newsletters, or on the occult hierarchy that rules the world. And we don't tell you what I say, we tell you what they say. We go to their publications, and you read things there that you'll find very difficult to believe. But I believe them all to be true. But then we ask you, of course, to pray for America, to pray for revival, to pray for our leaders and ministers. But please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so we'll be back in this next hour here. Stand back here at Radio Liberty. coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, if you'd like more information about our the program, why you can call us off the air, but right now we ask you to hold your calls. We're having with us Steve from up in the Washington area. Steve used to live here in the Santa Cruz area where we are. In fact, he used to be a producer, evening producer on our programs, and he has a background in nuclear energy. He was trained in nuclear energy and in managing the engines that they have on submarines and on the naval ships, and as a result of why he is, of course, working in the nuclear industry up in the Washington area there. But I think it's important we give you a background of the truth about the nuclear energy. Now, we're told, oh, we can't have nuclear power plants in the United States. Why, they might blow up. You can almost imagine them melting down and, of course, melting all the way through to China. We can't have nuclear energy because we don't know what to do with the spent fuel. We can't have nuclear energy because we don't know what to do with all the slag that comes out of the uranium mines. We can't have nuclear energy because of the leakage of nuclear gases and nuclear products from these plants that endanger our health. Now, we are in the process, of course, of building, or at least guaranteeing the loans for the building of 5 nuclear power plants in China, I think to the tune of about $5 billion. China's got lots of money, but they're borrowing the money, and we're guaranteeing it. You, your taxpayers out there, are guaranteeing the money that's going to be placed under these nuclear power plants being built in China. They have nuclear power plants. I think France gets 80% of its electricity from nuclear. Certainly Japan is not quite that high, but it's 40 or 50% of the electricity in Japan comes from nuclear. But here in America, they have convinced the American people that nuclear power plants are not safe. Well, I want Steve to talk to you and tell you what he knows about them, because he's worked very close to them. Steve, were you on a submarine, or where were you working with the power plants?
I was on an aircraft carrier when I was in the Navy.
Okay, you were on an aircraft carrier, and, you know, I was at a meeting not too long ago, and some activist came up to me and said, would you want to, you know, have a nuclear power plant in your backyard? And so I said, well, my son was, you know, spent years on an aircraft carrier, and they all have nuclear powered engine, nuclear engines, and he didn't know the worse for wear for it. Why are you concerned about nuclear power plants? So I'm going to let you pick up and tell us how they work and whether we should be concerned about them or not.
Okay. Well, how they work is a fairly simple process. There's a certain level of enrichment for a fuel, either plutonium or uranium. Most of your commercial plants, it's a very low enrichment. In the Navy, it's an exceptionally high enrichment. The Navy actually uses a weapons-grade type of uranium fuel in it, and that's not very cost-effective, but it's very efficient. And
but basically, isn't it just run like any other power plant based upon production of steam that turns the turbines? Aren't all nuclear power plants, aren't power plants, whether they're oil burning or coal burning or, you know, natural gas burning or nuclear, based upon this whole idea of production of steam that turns the turbines?
Yeah, the steam cycle is identical to a fossil fuel plant. There's really no difference at all. Once the steam comes out of the steam generator in a nuclear plant or a boiler in a fossil fuel plant, the steam part of the cycle works identical.
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Steve Henninger, and we're going to be talking about nuclear power plants and how they work, and whether it be in an aircraft carrier or in a submarine. And the submarines, our submarines are powered by nuclear fuel. and the people live in close proximity to those nuclear reactors, you know, for all the time they're at sea? And are there any health effects, as far as you know, among the military people who work adjacent to these nuclear power plants?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, the amount of radiation that that you receive working anywhere near a nuclear power plant is completely insignificant compared to the amount of radiation that you receive in your normal day-to-day business. Somebody that works in a field as picking vegetables or a construction worker that's out in the sun all day long will receive significantly higher doses of radiation than somebody working in a nuclear power plant.
And so this is really not a factor. Now, how is it that you are able to protect yourself from the nuclear emissions?
Well, the reactors are designed with several layers of shielding that start from the core itself, and the cores are very highly radioactive as they're critical and producing enough heat to generate the steam, and but that is shielded within the reactor itself, and just outside the reactor, the radiation levels will drop off significantly, but they're still lethal. You could survive maybe 30 minutes or a half hour, or 30 minutes or an hour in the reactor compartment, where you're outside the reactor, but you're still not in the secondary shielding. In your secondary shielding, where your reactor compartment is, it'll have walls that are made of lead and plastics and waters and other types of shields to shield neutrons and gamma radiation. When you're outside of the secondary shielding, the radiation levels are below what you would normally see in an agricultural environment or in an airplane or in some other.
And so if you actually go up an airplane and go to live in Denver, don't you get a lot more radiation than you would working adjacent to a nuclear reactor?
Yeah, in fact, if you fly from Santa Cruz or San Jose to Florida, you're going to get more radiation in one trip than somebody working in a nuclear power plant would get in a year.
Well, then what about, of course, the nuclear emissions that get into the air or that get into the water from these nuclear power plants?
Well, as far as emissions go, there's quite a bit of emissions that go into the air.
Hold that thought there for just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Steve. He works with a nuclear power plant. He's worked with him when he was in the Navy, and, of course, he's working in the Washington area and with nuclear power plants there. And we were simply asking about the nuclear emissions from a nuclear power plant. Now, what about the nuclear emissions, then, that go into the air?
Well, there's a significant amount of emissions that commercial power plants release into the air, but they're very short-lived radionuclides, and they dissipate very quickly, and they're not contaminant in the sense of like a fossil fuel plant that releases a smoke or an ash into the air where it exists for a period of time. You breathe into your lungs, it gets all over the houses and the cars and causes a pollution. The krypton and the xenon and the other radioactive noble gases that come out of the final release of stuff in a reactor, they're short-lived and they're non-reacting because they're noble gases.
But I mean, either alpha rays or gamma rays or neutrons, or what sort of radiation is there in these new noble gases?
They decay in a variety of emissions. I don't know if any of them are neutron emitters. But certainly there'll be some alpha emitters and gamma emitters. But I mean, that's not unusual. But radon is a gas that we live with 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And if you live in a high desert area, or if you live in an agricultural area like where I live, or in Santa Cruz, radon's exceptionally high. And all of radon's decay daughters are all alpha emitters. And For the audience, I was actually going to talk maybe a little bit about what radiation is.
All right, fine. We'll let you do that.
There's four basic types of radiation. They are alphas, betas, gammas, and neutrons. your alpha is, is essentially a charged helium atom, very, very big compared to the other forms of radiation, and it has no ability to penetrate your skin or your clothes, but you breathe it in, and it can damage your lungs. A significant portion of the damage that you get from smoking cigarettes is from radon. The tobacco fields are very rich in radon, and when the cigarette gets packaged, all the tobacco has radon in it, and you smoke it, it goes right into your lungs. We've done some pretty funny experiments with portable air detectors and cigarettes, and you get a pretty high dose from smoking a single cigarette.
Steve, are you on a regular telephone, or are you on a handheld telephone?
Yeah, I'm on a regular telephone.
Okay, go ahead then.
And then you have betas.
Steve, are you there? Well, I think it looks like we lost Steve, and I'm going to ask my producer to get Steve back again, and maybe that's going to get a little bit better coverage when we get him back. But, of course, there's the alpha, which is a helium atom. There is the beta. There is a gamma, and there's a neutron. Now, you can have a certain amount of radiation. They've tried to frighten the people to death about the danger of radiation. And let me point out that the studies have shown radon in your home. If you have radon in your home, you have less chance of getting cancer or other diseases than if you live in an area without radon. And that may sound ridiculous to you, but you must understand the truth of the matter is that you need a certain amount of stimulation, and the stimulation actually increases your immune response. And there's a friend that we've known, Dr. Bernard Cohen, who is a university professor, who's done extensive studies on areas where the radon and not radon. He's found a higher incidence in areas, I'm speaking now of lung cancer, in areas where there is no radon than where the radon levels are very high. And the contention is that the radon, low-dose radiation, actually is beneficial for the individual. In fact, they have found that the survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, if you were right there at the ground zero and you've got massive radiation, you simply died from the radiation. But you look at these people 30 years down the line, and of course what they found is that they have lived longer than the other people. Why? Because they had this tremendous stimulation of their immune system. And it's a paradoxical effect, but there's been an organized, orchestrated area and effort in the United States to convince people that any exposure to radiation levels is dangerous, and it's linear. If you have a little, you had a little bit of damage. If you have moderate amount, you have a moderate amount of damage. If you have a high level, you have a high amount of damage. That really isn't true. A little radiation actually is beneficial, and it actually stimulates your immune system. And the incidence of cancer in the areas with radon is actually less than the incidence of cancer in areas where there is no radon. This is a scam. People have made a lot of money on this radon and radon detection. But if you look up the work of Dr. Bernard Cohen, you'll find that what we've said is true. This is well known within the scientific community. It took them a little while to realize that they'd been lied to by the Atomic Energy Commission, because there was an agenda, and that was we were not going to have nuclear energy. It was all right for we to have nuclear power plants in China or in Japan or in France or Germany. We just couldn't have them here in the United States. So pick up the story there. Steve, you were telling us about the alpha radiation and then the beta and gamma and neutrons. So pick up the story, please.
Okay, well, the betas are essentially just ionized electrons. They're very, very, very small, and they're usually fairly low energy. They also do not have any ability to really penetrate your skin except in real soft tissue areas like your eyes, and they're not really considered a threat. They're real low-risk radiation forms. And then the last two are gammas and neutrons, and these are the two that are most dangerous, and they're also the at least gammas are what we're most commonly exposed to. And a gamma doesn't have any real mass at all, but it has relative mass when it's moving, and it carries a certain amount of energy from very, very low energy stuff that you receive in like X-rays and even photons from lights can be considered real low level gamma energy. all the way up to extremely high stuff that comes out of a fission reaction that can be very damaging. And then neutrons have a significant amount of mass, and they have an infinite amount of energy, like the gammas do. The neutrons will pass right through your body, and they'll damage whatever they hit, and they'll cause secondary ionizations as they pass through cells and collide with other atoms. And so in your nuclear power plants, the shielding is basically designed to minimize both the gamma and the neutron radiation. And they do that. Neutrons are shielded with water and with plastics, and gammas are shielded with various metals, lead being the best. But steel also works real well.
Well, now, Steve, we hear these stories, and I don't know if they're true or not, about the people adjacent to certain nuclear power plants claim that their health has been impaired. Is there any truth to that, or is this simply a scam?
Well, it's hard to say, because I don't know the facts behind any of those claims. You have an area like Hanford where I work, and there at one time was about 14 operating reactors here, some of them being built all the way back in the very first ones. The Hanford site was famous for its work on building Fat Man, which was one of the two first nuclear bombs. And there was some pretty sloppy work that was done up here as far as controlling waste products. So when you're building a nuclear bomb, you use a lot of real corrosive acids and bases and some really nasty chemicals and other types of stuff to separate out the plutonium or the uranium, whichever you're working with, to enrich it and refine it. And some of the earlier facilities here were pretty irresponsible in how they treated the environment. So if you looked to some of the broader things that went on with nuclear power plants like that, you could see some hazardous byproducts as far as health goes. But as far as the nuclear reactor itself, it doesn't produce anything toxic at all. It's extremely clean in its form of energy production. It's very, very safe. Three Mile Island, was really the turning point in U.S. reactors, where the public just said, we've had enough. It caused the Washington public power system to go bankrupt, as they were in the process of building five reactors when Three Mile Island occurred, and of the five, only one survived, and the company went bankrupt and all kinds of other stuff.
But that was really more a publicity stunt than more of anything. It was timed to coincide with that movie that was coming out with, of all people, with Jane Fonda and Zach Lemon. It was called The China Syndrome, and it was interesting how they played the public, and you had this image reading, the newspapers about the any time there was going to be a tremendous hydrogen bomb explosion. They were talking about the hydrogen radioactive gas that was there. They had to release that, and all the people and the animals and everything that was dying around the Three Mile Island plant. What's the truth about Three Mile Island?
Three Mile Island is an evidence as to how safe these reactors are. Three Mile Island was three crews of operators for more than 24 hours that let a major, major problem with the steam plant continue to go on totally unchecked and totally uncorrected, and the plant absolutely protected itself. It did not release a single thing into the environment. All of its release was contained in the containment buildings that were designed for such an emergency. And Three Mile Island still has an operating plant. A friend of mine just went and interviewed out there last week, right next door to the one that's disabled.
And I really think that this was a publicity stunt. I love that line that they used to have, that far more people died in the back seat of Ted Kennedy's car at Chappaquiddick than died at Three Mile Island. But the American people were never allowed to know that. And it's amazing, if you control the media, why you can get the people to believe anything, even if it isn't true. And usually it isn't. We'll be right back here in just a moment to talk more about nuclear energy. And if you have any questions, give us a call. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Steve, who works at Hanford, and he's been around nuclear energy for a long period of time, having been trained in this when he was in the Navy. Now, one of the big things that they keep bringing up over and over again, Steve, is what are we going to do with this spent fuel? What are we going to do? I mean, after all, we've got this problem. We don't know what to do with it. We want to put it in Yucca Mountain. Now we find out that they've been using a lot of phony science to say it's going to be safe at Yucca Mountain, and we can't have this spent fuel. It's going to get in the water supply. It's going to somehow contaminate the whole world. What are we going to do with the spent fuel, and how do you answer that argument?
Well, there's a couple of things to do with spent fuel. The first one would be to reprocess it. The facility that I work at is a fast flux test facility, and right next door to us is a brand new building called the Fuel Maintenance and Examination Facility. I think it's FMEF. And it's a building that was built in the 80s. It's brand new. It has never been used. Its sole purpose was for reprocessing. And about 2 weeks after it was completed, the government decided that they're not going to reprocess our fuel. And so to kind of put things in perspective, if you take all of the spent fuel in its current state, so not reprocessed, that all the United States has produced since the beginning of the nuclear age in the 40s, you would cover about 2 football fields about 4 feet deep. So we're not talking about a lot of material here at all. And if we reprocess this, if we reprocess that with current technology, you know, you'd cut that down in half at least, if not more so. And then there are other technologies that real significantly during the Clinton administration were just abandoned. The integral fast reactor from Argonne West Laboratories in Idaho, the fast flux test facility where I work at now, and some other research facilities around the country that were using a fast flux of there's no water cooling the reaction, and so you get a higher percentage of neutrons, and you have nothing to slow them down. And I don't want to get overly technical as to the process here, but it's a little different than your normal commercial plants are, and it can do a lot of really neat things in a controlled environment. And so in the fast flux world, the integral fast reactor and FFTF both have the ability, theoretically, to just burn this fuel out so that there is no more of the transuranic waste, of the real high-level, long-lived waste that is such a concern. And these projects were completely abandoned. FFTF, the place that I work at, it only operated for 10 years. A normal reactor will operate for more like 60 years. And it's a brand new, top of the line, really neat facility that can do some really exciting stuff in a test environment. And the government really just pulled the plug on it back in '92, and it sat in limbo until 2002, about 6 months after I hired on there. And then they just decided to pull the plug on it, and so we've been real busy draining it and offloading all the fuel.
I think it's so important that our listeners understand that there's an organized effort to create a problem when there was no problem there to begin with. But only when they create the problem can they come up with a solution. And if you understand that there's been every effort made to block the use of nuclear fuel here in America. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Steve, and he works at Hanford, and we're talking about this whole issue of what you do with the spent fuel. How many times have you heard that? Well, what does France do with their spent fuel? They reprocess it. What does Japan do with their spent fuel? They reprocess it. What does Germany do with their spent fuel? They reprocess it. What do you think China will do with these new plants that we are guaranteeing the loans on, that we are building for communist China? Westinghouse is building them, and we're guaranteeing the loans from some international agency. We're guaranteeing the loans for communist China when they've got, you know, a couple of $100 billion of our money actually in their reserves. Why are we lending them money? Why we're building the best enemy money could buy. But they're going to reprocess their spent fuel. So why don't we process it here? Why the environmental lobby, which is funded by our great corporations and by our great tax-exempt foundations and by our own government, because the government gives money to these various environmental agencies to lobby the government to do what the government wants. And they've wanted to block any effort to have nuclear power in the United States. Why was that? Why, very simply, so that we'd have to burn coal, and so we'd have to burn oil, and so we would have to burn natural gas and drive their prices up and create the problem. The solution was there. They didn't want a solution. And that is the incredible thing. You reprocess the nuclear fuel. Why doesn't anybody talk about that? Why don't they talk about that, Steve? I don't think that the average person in the listening audience has any idea that we knew how to reprocess that fuel 30 years ago. We knew how to do it during the Carter administration, and we were not allowed to do it then, and we're still not doing it today.
Well, you know, I think as just a technical point, don't quote me, but I don't think that Germany reprocesses their fuel. I'm pretty sure that they send it to France.
Well, they do. They send it to France, and France reprocesses. Right.
Well, in the Carter administration, and I don't know all the details of all this. It's not my strong point, but during the Carter administration, Carter signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Act, and that's what caused the ban on reprocessing of fuel. That ban was lifted during the Reagan administration, but the country never really went ahead with reprocessing. There's some expense issues with reprocessing, and there's some security issues, though I don't fully understand them, and that may just be pure propaganda, but part of the reason that I understand that they don't reprocess fuel has to do with having enriched fuel in a location where it's stealable, but I don't see how that's any different than making the fuel in the first place.
Well, I think that they want the problem, and if they didn't have the problem, they wouldn't be able, of course, to have all the problems today, and driving up the price of oil and driving up the price of natural gas, and really this all has to do with making it increasingly difficult for the American people, and gradually, of course, lowering our living standards. That's what it's really all about. When you understand that, it makes sense. If you're looking at it from a logical point of view, nothing makes sense. But there's been an organized, orchestrated, coordinated effort to block the use of nuclear power plants in the United States, as our technology, and it was our technology, is exported all throughout the rest of the world, and Westinghouse, an American corporation, is building nuclear power plants in China, but gee, we can't have them here in the United States. And of course, they're being financed, the loans are being guaranteed by the United States. But for the Chinese, so that they can have nuclear power and cheap electricity, but we can't have it here. And if that makes sense to you in the audience, why, you're a lot smarter than I am. Unless you understand that this is a scam. And when you understand it's a scam, it all makes sense. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And Steve, another thing that these people argue is, what about all the tailings? What about all the material that's brought up when they're mining the uranium ore? How do you respond to that?
Not familiar with that argument at all. You know that our country is extremely rich in uranium, and it's a resource that's completely untapped. And I did write down some numbers as far as mining uranium goes. 1 ton of uranium oxide produces about 40 million kilowatt hours of energy from a nuclear power plant. And in order to get that same amount of energy out of coal, you need about 16,000 tons. And in order to get that same amount of energy out of oil, you'd need about 80,000 barrels. So the uranium is a much more available resource than the fossil fuels are, and it produces, and part of what makes it so much more efficient is it produces so much more energy per ton than the other fossil fuels.
And of course, what it does is it actually creates heat, and the heat actually causes water, which they have in the reactor, to turn into steam and drive the steam turbine. And there's not probably one in 1,000 Americans who know how a nuclear power plant acts. And the reason, you're not supposed to. We'll be back here in just a moment with Steve. We'll welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and Roger had called in, and he had said that the word I was thinking of when we were talking about the benefits of low-dose radiation is called hormesis, and that's right, that's the phrase that's used in the scientific community, and it's hormesis, and it means that you actually get benefit from very low-dose radiation, and Dr. Bernard Cohen, C-O-H-E-N, has done extensive work on that. You can get that off the Internet, or, of course, if you can't get it off the Internet, why, we'll be glad to help you get the information, but you need to understand that very low-dose radiation is not harmful for you. Intermediate or high-dose radiation is not good for you, but the low-dose radiation is actually, in many cases, beneficial. So we're talking with Steve here, who works at Hanford. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. And I, of course, had this recent discussion with a young man who actually is just hates nuclear power. He thinks it's the worst thing in the world. And his question to me is, what are you going to do with all the tailings from the mining? And well, my solution would be just to put it back in the mines where it came from. It came out of the ground. It could go back into the ground. This is a non-problem. But they want to create all the problems because they're doing everything they can to block nuclear power. And a lot of people, honest people, sincere people, are firmly convinced that if we have nuclear power plants, why we're going to have nuclear explosions. So then, well, then they will always point to Chernobyl. Chernobyl is the situation. And look at what happened at Chernobyl and the terrible pollution there. Steve, how do you respond to that argument?
Well, those would be two different questions. As far as a nuclear power plant becoming some sort of catalyst in a nuclear explosion or crashing a plane into it, causing it to turn into a big nuclear bomb, is absolutely physically impossible. It just cannot happen. Even in a Navy Corps, where a Navy Corps is a weapons-grade fuel, the geometry is such that, you know, that even if you hit a Navy ship with a nuclear bomb, it's not going to cause the nuclear material that's in the ship to become part of that bomb. Nuclear bombs are extremely precise in their geometry. The nuclear fuel has to fit together exactly perfectly in order for the chain reaction to occur to cause the supercritical, prompt critical explosion of a nuclear bomb. And commercial plants, it's even more impossible because they don't use anywhere near a weapons grade fuel.
Well, that's off right there for a minute, Steve, as we bring our stations on board. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest this evening is Steve, and he works at Hanford, and we're just talking about what's going on. And this, I asked him the question about this concept that, you know, if you have a nuclear power plant, you could get a nuclear explosion. So why don't you pick up the whole story there? This is really the confusing words. They're talking about two things, the word nuclear, but there are lots of things that are nuclear that do not have the potential for an explosion. It has to be very, very specifically designed to get an explosion, doesn't it, Steve?
It's very critical that the geometry in a nuclear weapon be exact, that the timings have to be exact, the proportions and explosions and dimensions and everything about how a bomb works has to be precise, or it just doesn't work. And in the commercial nuclear power plant industry, they're only using an enrichment of somewhere around 30-35%, which is no. If you took all of their nuclear fuel and you put it in the right geometry, it still wouldn't blow up like a bomb. It doesn't have enough nuclear material in it.
And it's not weapons-grade plutonium. It's just simply, it's an enriched uranium.
Right. And it's just, and the more important thing is it's not in the right geometry.
Right.
So even if you crashed a plane into it, and I've seen some pretty interesting stuff as to what happens when a plane hits the containment construction of a reactor, the plane essentially disintegrates. Our reactors our facilities are built pretty stoutly against such type attacks. But you could, if you did something like that, you may be able to cause damage. You could rupture the steam plant. You could make a mess. You could blowing up anything is going to make a mess. But you can't cause a nuclear power plant to become a nuclear bomb. It just doesn't work that way.
Well, and then let's talk about Chernobyl, because this, of course, is the boogeyman, Chernobyl. And we associate Chernobyl with barren fields and people dying of radiation poisoning. And Chernobyl really was a catastrophe, wasn't it?
Oh, it was horrible. Chernobyl's a really interesting and very unique situation. At Chernobyl, you had a system design that was not only antiquated, it was dangerous inherently. It was very, very, very different from any U.S.-designed reactor. And in Chernobyl, part of the built-in structure, part of the problem, is that they used the graphite blocks as their moderator to continue the fission process, where most reactors of this type in the United States would use water primarily as their moderator. When the water boils away, that would cause the reaction to shut down. Yeah, but in the Chernobyl one, they were working in extremely low temperatures at very, very low powers. The reactors are not as stable in those conditions. They had scientists that were directing the operators to do things that the operators would not normally ever do, and when you're at really low powers, the change in power happens over decades of change. And so, and how to describe this? If you're at an operating power, you change power from 1% to 2% to 3% to 4%. But when you're at really low powers, you change things from 1 to the minus 10th amps to 1 to the 10 to minus 9th amps to the 10 to the minus 8th amps. Your scale is totally different. And so when power starts moving rapidly in the low power ranges, it's moving very, very rapidly. And so in the Chernobyl incident, they had the rods, the control rods, which it's hard to say all this stuff without assuming the audience knows something. The control rods are big neutron sponges, and when they're all the way down, the reactor can't fission.
No, by down, you mean they're into the graphite?
Yeah, the control rods are in between the fuel cells.
All right.
So they're also in between the graphite. They go up and down. They're the only movable part in the reactor. And when they're all the way down, they're big neutron sponges. So any uranium that spits out a neutron, the control rod will immediately suck it up and not allow it to fission. Well, as you pull the rods up and you expose the fuel and you expose the moderator so that the uranium can spit out a neutron, the neutron can hit the moderator and slow down and slow down and slow down and get sucked up into another uranium atom. The other uranium atom will split in half and spit out a couple more neutrons. So as you pull up these rods, this allows the nuclear process to occur.
And, of course, what you're doing is generating heat. And
not yet.
You're not generating heat?
Not yet. At your low powers, you're not creating enough energy to really see a noticeable change in temperature yet. But it starts coming up really, really fast. And so as they were pulling these rods, at one point the operator said, "Hey, look, power's starting to come up real fast, and I'm not comfortable with the height that the rods are at." And they kind of panicked, and they drove rods in real fast. And again, because of the dynamics and the construction of the reactor, this caused a small power spike. And so it would have gone up first a little bit before it started coming back down. But when they saw the power spike, they panicked, and they dropped all the rods at once. Through a signal, it's called a scram. It just releases the electrical power to all the rods, allows them all to drop at once. Well, they were up so high, and the reactor was in such a condition that this caused power to go way up really fast. It's called going prompt critical. And so the temperatures and the pressures and everything inside the reactor built so fast, and with no place to release this energy, that it actually blew this 150,000-ton lid with bolts that are torqued down to several million foot-pounds of torque, blew this lid right off of its bolts, and and then the lid came back down into the reactor sideways. Now, in most Navy Corps or most U.S. reactors, this would have been the end of the accident right there. The reactor would have shut down. There would have been a mess. It would have been all contained in a containment dome. All the people would have been protected. All the environment would have been protected. But at Chernobyl, they didn't have a containment dome. They didn't have anything to contain this accident in. And because of the moderator, the graphite, the way it was set up, the fission continued to occur and continued to generate heat without any way to cool it off. And this caused the sand that was in the shielding to melt into the graphite and the uranium and the fuel and the everything else that was there, and made this big kind of hodgepodge of radioactive nastiness that did actually melt down. It actually melted down about three stories before it stopped, so it didn't quite make it to the other side of the world, but it did go down a couple of stories in this building.
Well, now, was there a steam explosion associated with it? Was there, in other words, did some of the water get very hot and simply just spew out the graphite, radioactive graphite? Or how did they disseminate the radioactivity from Chernobyl?
Well, the radioactive, when the lid blew off the reactor, and steam was a big part of that. You have your reactor is kind of a really big vessel. It's a really big tank, and it's full of water. And when took a pot full of water and you put a lid on it that wouldn't come off, and you heated the water up to 500 degrees so that the water was capable of turning to steam, and then the bolts gave way on your lid, it would, all this pressure from the steam would blow your lid right through the roof.
And really, wasn't this more or less a steam explosion carrying along these radioactive particles with them then?
Oh yeah, but your their whole reactor disintegrated in this process, and it sent plutonium dust all over the place. It made a real mess.
How about the graphite? Wasn't that radioactive too?
Yeah, the graphite's a moderator. It's somewhat radioactive. It just made a mess, carrying
the radioactive particles with
right,
it. It would
right,
be radioactive
exactly.
itself, but the radioactive particles with the graphite and then the steam, and just spew this all over everything.
Yeah, and there's no containment building. So in a Navy, or not in a Navy, I got to get myself out of the Navy. In a U.S. Corps, you're required to have a containment dome. You cannot have a reactor without a containment dome.
And I think this is really what's important. If you have ever seen, I'm speaking now to the listening audience, you see a nuclear power plant, what do you see? You see that dome. At Chernobyl, they didn't have a dome.
Right.
They had their reactor, and they had a tar and gravel roof there. And, of course, when the reactor went critical, there was nothing to contain it. They had made no preparations. I mean, there's not one nuclear reactor in the United States that doesn't have one of those domes, which is a containment dome, and anything goes on will be contained within inside there. And you can crash a freight train or a 747 into those, and apparently they won't do any damage at all. So they're very, very solidly built. In Russia, there was no containment. That was what happened at Chernobyl. It wasn't that there was anything wrong with nuclear energy. It wasn't that they did everything wrong, but they had not made a containment vessel to protect either the people who worked there or the surrounding countryside. So then what happened? How much damage was actually done, Steve, there at Chernobyl?
From my understanding, quite a bit. there was a subsequent fire that happened after the explosion. There was a tremendous release of radioactive contamination that drifted all the way up to Finland and created several hot spots along the way. And I've seen some stuff online about the town there associated with Chernobyl. Some of the stuff I recognize as propaganda or not entirely accurate as far as what radiation does, but some of it seems to be legitimate. So I don't know all the specific details of what happened to the nearby town, but I can imagine Chernobyl was a big reactor and would have made a really big mess. And I know that almost all the firemen or all the firemen died real soon after because they were sent into this extremely highly radioactive environment. And I've actually seen pictures of them. You know, they tell them they got 30 seconds to run in and do this and get back out, but even that 30 seconds was too much. And so most of those first responders there, I know, died. The long-term effects, there's another reactor at Chernobyl that is operating still, but I've read some stuff that there was some more significant damage kind of downwind of Chernobyl, the nearest town there. I think the town is called Chernobyl, but don't quote me on that.
Well, I think that what's so significant for Americans to understand is this could not happen in the United States because our plants are built to protect the workers. They're built to protect the surrounding environment. The one in Russia, no concern at all. In fact, they were building one like that down in Cuba. Not whether those have ever been made operational, but they built them exactly the same way as they did in Chernobyl, right down in Cuba. Have they ever gotten operational, do you know, in Cuba?
I'm not familiar with an operating power plant in Cuba one way or the other. I would like to say with Chernobyl, though, that it's also important to realize or recognize that Chernobyl was not under normal operations. They had a group of people in there, scientists, government, whoever was pulling the strings, that was forcing that reactor into an unsafe condition. So even the Chernobyl reactor, for all intents and purposes, would have been a normally safe to operate reactor. They were intentionally bypassing and circumventing safety protocols, and they were putting the reactor in a position that they just shouldn't have been in.
Why did they do it? Do we have any idea why they would have taken that sort of a chance?
Well, that's a tough one to call their intentions. You know, I don't know. I've done reactor plant testing. I've been involved with it at the reactor I worked at in Idaho. And, of course, that happened right after Chernobyl. And so they were pretty sensitive to what we were doing. Well, we did some low-temperature, low-power reactor testing. But of course, you never, ever in the United States would defeat a safety interlock or allow the reactor to get anywhere near an unsafe condition. So maybe they had some legitimate reasons. Maybe I don't think it's terribly far-fetched to think that they did this intentionally just to harm the nuclear power industry. And maybe that's a reach, maybe it's not. I have no proof on that.
Well, I think that it is very, very difficult to imagine that they would have done these things unintentionally. Let's go to Dale, who's calling in from the Aptos area, and hopefully we'll have Dale just screen through to us. Hi, Dale. Do you have a question for our guest?
Yes. I've been listening to the show all through the evening, and I'm curious about people that are involved. Namely, there's Rumsfeld. I haven't heard his name mentioned, and that I understand he was instrumental in facilitating the deal that enabled North Korea to have nuclear power, and I'd like to have just the guest response on that, and I'll take it on the air.
Thanks very much. And of course, it's interesting that we'll build a nuclear power plant for North Korea, but we can't have nuclear power plants here in America because they're too dangerous. And it's all right for it to happen in China and everybody else in the world using American technology. I believe that they have intentionally created the problem because they have a different solution. And one thing is, they have actually held off the development of nuclear power plants in the United States for, well, almost 30 years. So what do you think about the fact that we're helping the North Koreans or actually building a plant for the North Koreans, a nuclear power plant, but we can't have them here in the United States?
Yeah, I don't know the details of that, Stan. I haven't been following my global politics much lately.
Well, all I can say is that what Dale says is true, and we were actually building these nuclear power plants for the North Koreans. So I have to ask yourself, why is it all right for the North Koreans to have nuclear power plants and for the Chinese communists to have nuclear power plants and for the Japanese and the Germans and the French and all throughout the world they can have nuclear power plants, but gee, they're just not safe here in the United States.
But, and you know, along those lines, as far as the future of nuclear power in our own country, the Generation 4 technology, which is the next batch of U.S. reactors that are under discussion right now, They have some really, really neat technology, some stuff that is just incredibly safe, incredibly efficient, produces almost no waste byproducts at all. It's some really neat stuff, and this, you had mentioned at the beginning that the Congress has approved the building of, I think you said five, I'd heard seven, I'm not sure the exact number, and I'm not sure if they're actually going to get built or not, but new reactors for the country, which are very needed. Our reactors are getting old, some of them. The last batch of reactors that was built came online in the early 1980s, but all the ones older than that, some of the reactors are getting close to like 60 years old. A lot of them have been shut down already.
All right, well, we're going to just hang on there. We'll be back in just a moment, and we'll be glad to wrap up this program very soon. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I certainly think we need nuclear power, but they really, of course, want to deindustrialize America. And if you can take away our ability to have electricity, and they're actually tearing down dams that are being used to generate hydroelectric power, efforts are being made, of course, to limit the amount of emissions from all of our conventional power plants. And really, there's far less emissions from the nuclear power plant and dangerous emissions, far less from the nuclear power plant than from the coal-burning power plants that we have across America. And certainly, they are much cheaper to run. And it seems like we don't want the solution. What we really want is a problem. Let's go to Roger. Roger, you have a quick question?
Yes, I wanted to ask, and you did mention about the radon.
Right, we did mention that the radon, they call that hormesis, which means you actually will actually stimulate your immune system and be healthier with low-dose radon. But don't tell the American people that.
Yeah, no, even if after it's been proven to the EPA, of course, that their numerical arguments against radon hazards are not proven, they continue to recycle it every year.
Okay, did you have a question for our guests?
Yeah,
we're just about out of time.
Yeah, we do know that the radiation emissions from coal-fired power plants are higher than from nuclear plants, but we also possibly know that for natural gas-fired plants.
Do you have any thoughts on that at all?
He's absolutely correct.
You mean you're going to get more radiation from a coal-fired plant than you will from a nuclear plant?
Yeah, in fact, you get a lot of radiation from a lot of places that you wouldn't suspect. And I know when I worked in Idaho, there was a fertilizer plant in Pocatello, which is the next closest city, and I read an article in the paper there that fertilizer plant releases completely uncontrolled and directly into the environment more than 3 curies a day. Now, a nuclear power plant wouldn't be allowed to release 3 microcuries into the environment a year because of the restrictions and the regulations that are involved in it. But fossil fuel plants, coal, lots of mining operations, anything fertilizer-oriented, so you're dealing with phosphorus and some nitrates. You get all kinds. The radiation is everywhere. It surrounds us all the time. It's foolishness to condemn nuclear power because of its radioactive element. Radiation is a normal, everyday part of our lives.
Amen to that. Well, Roger, thanks very much. And as far as... Steve, thank you for very much. It's been a fascinating hour, and I've learned a lot. I hope our listeners out there across America have as well.
And I close with a website for you. It's the Nuclear Energy Institute. It's NEI.org.
NEI.org. Thank you.
All right, Ken.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening, Steve, an old-time friend. And I just wanted to, of course, go over the background of nuclear energy, NEI.org. Steve says there's a lot of great information there if you want to look into it. But remember, when they tell you that they're not safe to have in your backyard, just remember we have them in all of our naval ships, our major naval ships, whether they be aircraft carriers or submarines. These are nuclear reactors. They're perfectly safe. People live right next to them, and they're not dying, and they're not having any problems from that. As far as the not knowing what to do with the spent fuel, do you reprocess it? But, of course, they really don't want the solution. They want the problem. So there really are some very, very powerful forces out there that have created the problem and really want, of course, to deindustrialize the United States. This is really what it's all about. This is exactly what the environmental movement is about, is the destruction of our country so that we cannot be competitive with the rest of the world. And you say, that's crazy talk. Who would want to do that? And I would simply suggest you get the book Set Up and Sold Out, goes into the background of the environmental movement, certainly our 4-tape set on sustainable development, our video on sustainable development and the New World Order, and then finally our sustainable development syllabus, which will give you the documentation you need. And you'll actually read there the summary of the Global Biodiversity Assessment that came out of the Second Earth Summit in 1992, where they talk about the necessity of limiting the population and getting people out of their cars and actually creating food shortages. And as they say, shortages of food are really better than abundance. And you may think that that's a ridiculous statement, as do I, but you must understand there are people out there who have a different worldview. And they hate humanity. You need to get into the background of the message on the Georgia Guidestones. That's all covered in the Sustainable Development Syllabus. And then, of course, you need to read the Earth Charter, which is written by three of the most powerful men in the world. Mikhail Gorbachev, Marie Strong, and Stephen Rockefeller. And, of course, we have copies of the Earth Charter and the Sustainable Development Syllabus. You need to get the information. You need to understand that there are people who look at the world differently than you and I. If you'd like to know more about these items, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. We hope many of you will go to our website at radioliberty.com, where you can, of course, read our newsletters, where you can pull down our programs live 3 hours a day, either directly or linking to the other networks. And then you can pull down our archive programs. And what we want you to do is copy the newsletters, record and copy the programs, and help us get the truth out across America. Our country is under attack today, not from a terrorist, not from communists, not from, and we really have enough, probably hundreds of thousands of communist agents in this country today. And many of them come from communist China, and maybe they'd like to come here and be free, but if you are here and you're Chinese, why, they will tell you that they will take care of your family back in China if you don't go along with them, or they will, of course, make your life miserable here. And if you don't think that they will kill people in this country, you really don't understand much about communism. But communism is not the enemy. Communism has been created and financed by people here in the United States. And you say, why would they do that? It is simply because there really are secret societies. There is an occult movement. And if you would like to go to our website and pull down our last two newsletters, that's May and June of this year, we talk about the occult hierarchy that rules the world. The occult hierarchy that rules the world and creates wars, and, of course, they're real. We quote from what they tell you. They will tell you they have people working in the White House and the state houses all across this country. That's the occult hierarchy. Our website, radioliberty.com. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. And finally, of course, we ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival, and to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection.